Well, thank you, Mr. Miller. I'd like to begin today by telling you a story, because everyone loves a story. True story happens to be, in this case, about how sometimes very good people can make a really bad decision. Now, I know you've never experienced like that, so you'll probably be very interested in the story because it'll be so common or so foreign to our thinking that it won't be common to any of our experience, no doubt. A number of years ago, can't tell you how many, but we were going to make a long trip in our van. And the purpose of the trip was to carry a group of teenagers, fine young people, halfway across the country to the Teton Mountains of Wyoming, or where is that in Wyoming? West Virginia? It's over there somewhere. All the way to Wyoming, a long trip in the car. We didn't have room for all of the teens in our car. We're pulling our camping trailer behind us, going out to the camp in the Tetons. Outstanding experience it will be for our young people. There were so many teens who wanted to go that year that we had another car following us. And of course, as we drove through, you know, Ohio, Indiana, into Illinois, up into Wisconsin, picked up a couple of the teens, drove across the Dakotas. We get out to, we're going to see Yellowstone National Park for a day or two before the camp begins down in the Tetons. What an outstanding experience. We get to the park, Yellowstone National Park, and we go to the campsite. And the idea was, when you get to the campsite, you got a reservation, just pick out an empty campsite and take it. And of course, we arrived rather late in the day. Okay, it was almost night. Okay, it was dark. Saw a campsite that had nothing on it, so we pulled in and began to unpack and start to set up our little camping trailer and you know, just jack it up and get settled. And sure enough, this giant RV comes in, one of these, you know, hotels on wheels. These things are bigger than my house. They're huge. And the guy gets out and says, hey, this is our camping spot. And we said, well, we didn't see anything here. We already had a couple of tents set up in our little camping trailer. And we didn't notice anything. So, look, I got it. It says right here. Here's our camping spot. Well, there was nothing here. So, no problem. We'll go ahead and move. So, crank it down. Pack up the tents and go try to find something. Well, there was nothing else there. So, the person who runs the campground sees us wandering around and says, well, we've got an emergency spot, come on over here. Now, the emergency camping spot is, guess where? Right next to the toilet facilities. If you ever have to stay at Yellowstone, get there early so you don't have to stay next. There's this fragrance that seems to waft through the air that you don't picture when you think of Yellowstone National Park. Well, we went ahead and parked there and set things up. And some of our young men, the four guys in this car, thought, can we run up to the little camp store and we'll go ahead and pick up a few things, don't have toothpaste or whatever it was, wanted to get a snack. So we said, fine. So we're finishing setting up the camp and the boys drive off and then they come back about an hour later. And sure enough, accompanying them is the security guard for the campground. And first thing he says, are you in charge of this group? Boom. I said, I've never seen these boys in my life. I have no idea. No. I said, yes. Well, it ends up what they had done, and they're fine young men to this day. Now they're young adults, and they've got their families and all kinds of things like that. But they were good kids who made a really bad decision. They thought it would be funny as they were driving back from the camp store to drive past the place where we were supposed to, or at least we thought we were supposed to be camping, and pay the owner of this house on wheels a little visit. So what they were accused of was throwing rocks at this fellow's RV. And so I looked the boys in the eye, did you throw rocks at somebody's RV? And they said, no. We threw jelly beans. So it was a handful of jelly beans. One of the boys thought it would be a great idea. Wouldn't it be funny? So as they drove past, they chucked out this handful of jelly beans. And it, of course, all over the side of this man's trailer. So he thought it was either being shot at or he was having rocks thrown at. Now he got his lights out and he inspected his whole trailer and there was no damage. But really good kids just making a really bad decision. Any of you ever had something similar? I know probably you've never been jelly bean throwers at fancy trailers. But God's people sometimes, as good as we try to be, sometimes make some pretty bad decisions. Let's take a look at the life of an individual who seems to fall into that category. See what lessons we might be able to learn from his life. An outstanding man in so many ways, and yet, oh, made some bad decisions that were difficult and brought him pain and heartache that in some cases was very difficult to deal with. We're going to take a look at the life of a man by the name of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat. No, he wasn't a contestant on The Biggest Loser. Jehoshaphat is F-H-A-T, not F-A-T. Jehoshaphat was a king of Judah. This is after the time, of course, that Israel and Judah were split into separate nations. Israel had gone the way of idolatry since they split off from Judah. Judah at times would have righteous individuals ruling them. Jehoshaphat was one of them, a righteous king with whom God was very pleased most of the time. And I would think in that way, he's probably not too different from all of us. We hope that God is pretty pleased with us most of the time. So let's look at a few lessons from the life of Jehoshaphat, see how we might apply them to our modern situation today, and as a result, become better Christians, more closely aligned with God's way. The first lesson is this: build a barrier against evil. Build a barrier against evil. We'll talk more of what we mean by that as we go along. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 15. You may be thinking, well, I don't understand that. Hold on, we'll get to it. Build a barrier against evil. The story for Jehoshaphat really does not begin with Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, but it begins with Baasha, king of Israel. Now we'll read in 1 Kings chapter 15, beginning in verse 25, about what's going on in Israel, not what's going on with Jehoshaphat in Judah. But we need that as background to the story. It's kind of like, why would boys throw jelly beans at a trailer? That's such a random thing. But when you understand they took our spot, at least you think they did, made us camp next to the restroom, there's some backstory there. Well, there's some backstory to Jehoshaphat as well. 1 Kings 15 in verse 25. Now Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel just 2 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, walked in the way of his father, and in his sin by which he had made Israel sin. Well, why are we talking about Nadab? Well, we said the backstory is Baasha. Well, verse 27. Then Baasha, son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, conspired against him, and Baasha killed him at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel laid siege on Gibbethon. Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. So why do we start here? Baasha, the king of Israel, is a filthy murderer. Murderer. Evil individual. Here they are. They're attacking the Philistines, a common enemy. And in essence, he walks up behind the king and slits his throat. An evil individual. Goes on to say, how bad was he? Let's go on to chapter 16 in verse 1. Then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, inasmuch as I lifted you out of the dust, made you ruler over my people Israel, and you've walked in the way of Jeroboam, have made my people Israel sin, to provoke me to anger with their sins, surely I will take away the posterity of Baasha and the posterity of his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. You see, after he killed the previous king, he murdered the previous king's entire family. Completely wiped them out. Now you might say, well, that was God's vengeance on Jeroboam's family for doing what he did. You know, it's true. But what kind of person is that kind of murderer? I mean, women? children, just murdering them. So in verse 4 of chapter 16, the dog shall eat whomever belongs to Baasha and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the fields. Talk about a strict punishment. Now the rest of the acts of Baasha, what he did in his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Baasha rested with his fathers, was buried in Tirzah, and Elah his son reigned in his place. And also the word of the Lord came by the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha and his house, because of all the evil he did in the sight of the Eternal, in provoking him to anger with the work of his hands, in being like the house of Jeroboam, and because he was a filthy murderer. He killed him. So what do we have? We have to the north an evil, nasty king who will murder anyone whom he considers a threat. And then you have, south of that, King Jehoshaphat. Let's look in 2 Chronicles now, chapter 17. 2 Chronicles, chapter 17. And we begin picking up the story of Jehoshaphat here in 2 Chronicles 17. And now we'll begin to tie together this evil king Baasha in the north, the murderer, the one who has no compunction about wiping out women and children along with any possible threat to his throne, just kills their whole family, takes all their stuff. What relationship does this have to the southern kingdom of Judah and Jehoshaphat? Then Jehoshaphat, his son, meaning Asa's son, reigned in Asa's or his place and strengthened himself against Israel. What was he doing? He was building a barrier against evil. He was putting a barrier or a hedge between himself and what was evil. Verse 2. And he placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. So he built this hedge, this barrier. And as we read through this, I want you to ask yourself the question, what hedge have I set up between myself and evil? Between myself and what is wrong? Between myself and sin? Do I have any hedge? Do I have any barrier? Or is my life wide open? Can sin just waltz right through the door? Because there's no door there. The door is off the hinges. There's no protection whatsoever. Jehoshaphat was wise in building a fence between himself and the evil kingdom to the north, we might say. Verse 3. Now the Eternal was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals. In other words, the pagan gods. What fences have you built between yourself and evil? How do you construct a hedge so as not so easily to slip into sin? Does sin have free access into your life? Does it have access through your friends, the people you hang around with, your acquaintances? Does sin have access to you through your computer, your phone, your tablet, your television? Do you have any barriers set up so that there's an early warning system when sin approaches? You see, Jehoshaphat built these cities, fortified these cities to the north throughout Ephraim, so that if there was any incursion from the north, there would be a warning. There would be an ability to defend before they got to the heartland. You might stick a 3x5 card here in 2 Chronicles 17. We'll be back here in a moment. But turn with me to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. Do you have any barriers between you and sin? Surely your daily prayer is a barrier. As we pray to God and ask for His protection and ask for His help, ask for Him to stay the hand of Satan, that is one level of hedge and barrier. If there are issues that you know are going to be challenges in your life, it is certainly true that as Jehoshaphat monitored the land, he could pretty well predict where the weak points were. And so He fortified those areas. When we look at our lives, is it not true that we can pretty well discern where our weaknesses are? Where we'll be tempted? Where we'll be accosted by Satan the devil? Where we'll be tempted to sin? I think Christ could have predicted that when Satan made an attempt to throw Him off track. He knew there'd be some kind of attempt regarding His hunger after He'd fasted for 40 days. He knew there'd be some kind of attempt at humility and that issue of pride. If you are the Son of God, He knew those things, so He fortified Himself against them. Do we need barriers? Notice Mark chapter 12. This doesn't have to do specifically. We'll just take the principle out. The parable itself is not what we'll be looking at as far as the meaning of the parable. But in Mark chapter 12 and verse 1, then He, Christ, began to speak to them in parables. Then the first parable He gives here, a man planted a vineyard. So what is Christ going to illustrate? There's a guy that planted this vineyard. And what do smart, careful husbandmen do? They don't just plant it and leave it out there for any animal to come wandering through, take what they want, trample it down. They carefully plant it. And then what do? A man planted a vineyard in verse 1 and set a hedge around it. Why? Again, so animals couldn't come and just trample it. A bunch of cattle walk through and stomp all the grapevines and chew them off. So what would they plant around? They usually plant a hedge of thorns, which would discourage, obviously, the cows or other animals coming in there. Would also keep people out who shouldn't be in there. There were gates in the vineyards where people could come in and out, but not just wander in through the edges. The point was, a proper husbandman, which we are all called to be in one sense, guardians of God's truth in our lives, guardians of God's character that He's developing in us, a wise husbandman or woman will plant a hedge so that the heartland is protected, is safe. The heart, the inner heart of us is protected. So again, we can ask ourselves, what hedges have we built? Now it goes on to show what else a husbandman does. He digs it, place for the wine vat, builds a tower, leased it to the vine dressers, went too far. In other words, he did everything to make this right, to make it good. When we look at our spiritual vineyard, we might say, do we plant a hedge? Again, we said our daily prayer is a hedge against sin. Our regular Bible study is a hedge against sin. If we have a weakness, a particular area that we always seem to struggle with, do we take the time to do an intense Bible study on that particular topic? Thereby building a hedge around us and an early warning system, we might say. If human beings can be so astute as to build an early warning system for any number of threats, whether they be hurricanes or terrible storms or tornadoes or things like that, cannot we be astute enough as God's people to build a hedge regarding areas of our weakness? To know that here's where it's going to happen. If the incursion comes, here's where it will come. Sometimes we find ourselves in the aftermath of sin and we wonder, how did I allow this to happen? And upon analysis, we may find that we had no hedge. Sin was on top of us before we knew what hit us. So we set up those defenses early. If sin enters our home through our television, through our computer, through our tablet or our phone, we're careful to begin building hedges that will keep that sin away from the heartland. We're reading one individual who's very wise. They said, never let your child have a television in their bedroom or in their own room. Never do that. Don't ever do that where they can close the door and watch whatever they want. Bad idea. Don't ever let your child have their own computer in their own room where there's no monitoring going on. Not that we don't love our children and trust them and hope that they develop good judgment, but it should be in a public area of the home that the family functions around. It's a small hedge to help them not to be lured in something that's disastrous. It could be disastrous for them. So I'm not saying that's the policy of God's church, but I think parents need to think about some of those things when it comes to their children. Frankly, when it comes to ourselves, our computer should be in an area where others can have access to it, can come by and see what's going on. It's an important thing because temptation can enter there and it can be in the heartland before we know what hit us. So think about how we might build a hedge in whatever area of our life that we might be struggling in. If it's a temper issue, if there's an anger management problem going on in our home, how do we build a hedge so that we have an early warning system and a protection that way? How do I do that? Can I do certain things? So pray about that. Think about that, how that might be done. Share ideas with each other about the hedges that you're building to keep the heartland protected, keep the heart protected. We can learn from Jehoshaphat to construct a barrier in between us and evil. Let's go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 17 for a second lesson that we might learn from Jehoshaphat. And that is to hold God's way in high esteem. To hold God's way in high esteem. As we analyze the life of Jehoshaphat, we can see that one of the reasons God blessed him so greatly is because he held God's way in very high regard, very high esteem. Let's look at that in 2 Chronicles chapter 17. And now in verse 3, it says, "The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals, but sought," in verse 4, "sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the acts of Israel. Therefore," in verse 5, "the Eternal established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat. He had riches and honor in abundance." And then notice verse 6. "And his heart took delight in the ways of the Eternal. Moreover, he removed the high places and the wooden images from Judah." Focus again on that start of verse 6. "And his heart took delight in the ways of the Eternal." Jehoshaphat had no thought of God's way being a burden, of denying him anything that was good. He didn't consider it a shame to be a part of God's way, but a great honor to be a part of God's way. His heart took delight. I'd like to read that to you in the New American Standard Version. Verse 6 says this, "He took great pride in the ways of the Eternal." It's an interesting thought there. He took great pride in the ways of God. Isn't that true? When you think about God's way, do we take great pride in the ways of God? Not in a selfish way, not in a I'm better than you are way, but to see God's way, to see how well it's constructed, how perfectly it works, how good it is, the fruit that it produces, there's a right kind of pride in God's way. God's way is perfect, of course. No wonder we want to live it. No wonder we enjoy it. Holding God's way in high esteem. There was in Jehoshaphat a proper pride in understanding God's way and living God's way. I would guess, although it's not stated in so many words, I would guess that Jehoshaphat felt honored to be able to be used by God in representing His way. To think that God would reveal His way to him, that he would have the opportunity to be a representative of that way of life, something he was, I think, honored by. How about us? Do we take the same approach? Or do we let shame and embarrassment rule the day when we're asked about God's way, when we're confronted about God's way? Or do we understand what an honor it is to be a representative of God's way? Even though that representation may be ridiculed from time to time, even though it may be rejected from time to time, do we take honor from the fact that God has called us? Again, hold your spot here in 2 Chronicles, and we'll go to Psalm 37. Psalm 37 and verse 4. Rather than an embarrassment about God's way, realize that there is an opportunity to represent God's way in an honorable manner. Don't you suppose that when the righteous man by the name of Lot, living in the midst of really crooked people, really twisted people, do you suppose he considered it an honor at times to represent God's way? He must have. He told all those people, don't think to do this evil. Just don't do it. He was not afraid to tell them that they were doing what was wrong. He put a certain amount of pride in God's way. God's way is a beautiful way to live. And it provides great fruit. Psalm 37 and verse 4. David said this, delight yourself also in the eternal. Delight yourself also in the eternal. And he shall give you the desires of your heart. Do you think of God's way as a delight? When we hang up the work boots or the overalls at the end of a Friday afternoon, do we think of it as a delight to finally rest? To have a day to honor God? To picture the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God, the 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth? Do we think of that as a delight? Delight yourself in the Lord, and He shall give you the desires of your heart. Now, I think we could probably safely put in parentheses behind that, if it's good for us and at the appropriate time. Sometimes I've had desires of heart that are just wrong. God points that out over the course of time. No, you really don't want that. You think you do at this point, but it's not good. He actually changes the desires of our heart, if our heart is right. Turn over a few pages to Psalm 40. Psalm 40 in verse 8. Jehoshaphat held God's way in high esteem. David held God's way in high esteem. Held it in high regard. Considered it an honor to be called to this way of life and be a representative of God's way. Psalm 40 in verse 8 repeats that thought. I delight, David says, to do your will, O my God. It's a delight to be able to go in and tell the supervisor, I need this week off because it's my time to go to church festival. This is the Feast of Tabernacles. It's what the Bible says. I keep this festival from the Bible. It's not just a week off work, not going on vacation. This is a religious observance. To be able to be that witness to others is a great honor. David said, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. Jehoshaphat had that attitude. He wanted God's way held in high esteem. And that, going back to 2 Chronicles, leads us to the third lesson. Back to 2 Chronicles 17. And that is, the third thing we can learn from Jehoshaphat's life is to love teaching God's truth. You're not put on trial when someone asks about this way of life. You have the opportunity to teach that way, not knowing if that is the thing God will use to open their mind to truth. 2 Chronicles 17, in verse 7. Also, in the third year of his reign, he sent his leaders. Okay, he's only been on the throne for 3 years, and he's sending out leaders. He's taking great pleasure in teaching the way of God. So he makes sure that his leaders, and it lists quite a number of Ben-Hail, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nethaneel, Micaiah, etc., down through the list of Levites and priests, sends them, end of verse 8, Jehoram, the priests, Elishama. Verse 9, so they taught in Judah, and had the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. So not only did Jehoshaphat hold God's way in high esteem, he was delighted to be able to teach it to others in hopes that they would latch onto it themselves. Now, sadly, as we all know, the history of Israel and here of Judah was not one of latching on to God's truth. Some did, but others, many, many did not, unfortunately. So punishment would eventually come to Judah because of that fact. But that didn't discourage Jehoshaphat from teaching it, from sending out teachers to all these areas so that others could hear the right way to live. He loved God's way of life. He held it in high esteem, so he wanted to be sure that others had the opportunity to hear the truth and to practice it. And that's some of the reason we do what we do as members of God's church. We love God's way of life. We live it. We practice it. But we also want others to hear it as well. So we participate in the great work that God is doing so that others might be able to hear it. Others that we may never meet, that we may never know. Let's go again back to Psalm 40. We just left. We'll come back to 2 Chronicles in a few moments. Psalm 40 again. We'll read verse 8, but then continue on with what is stated afterward. Psalm 40, beginning in verse 8. We already read, "I delight to do your will, O God." Again, we said Jehoshaphat holds God's truth in high regard, high esteem. "I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart." Verse 9, what did that cause David to do here? "I have proclaimed the good news of righteousness in the great assembly." He wanted others to know this way of life. He wasn't shy about it at all. Indeed, he says, "I do not restrain my lips, O Eternal. You yourself know." Would God say that about us? "I've never hesitated to teach your way of life, to share it with others when we had the opportunity." Verse 10, "I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart." In other words, I haven't covered this up. I haven't pretended on the outside that I don't do these things when I do them. I haven't tried to show I fit in with everybody else out here, because we don't. "I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I've declared your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth from the great assembly." David was very willing to teach God's truth. He loved the truth. He wanted others to understand it, so he had not concealed it. In fact, he wrote a lot of songs about it, and this is one of them. Let's go back to 2 Chronicles then. 2 Chronicles chapter 17. Jehoshaphat loved God's truth so much that he sent ambassadors of that way all over the nation of Judah. God's way of life is so good, he has called individuals that he labels in the New Testament as ambassadors of his way of life. So rather than worry about persecution, because sometimes in the past we've shied away from teaching God's truth to others because we were kind of worried about persecution. You might bring persecution upon yourself. Doesn't sound like Jehoshaphat was too worried about persecution, nor was David. God has called us not as hidden individuals, but as ambassadors of His way of life. That's what we're called in the New Testament. So we should love the opportunity to teach God's truth to others. Ambassadors of God's way of life. We represent something different. Nothing to be ashamed about there. Back in 2 Chronicles chapter 17, pick this up in verse 10. "And the fear of the Eternal fell on all the kingdoms of the lands that were around Judah, so that they did not make war against Jehoshaphat." We'll pause for just a moment there. Was it the fear of armaments that caused the enemies to be at peace? Was it all the armies that Jehoshaphat had stacked up that caused the enemies to stand down? The answer is no. God placed fear into their hearts. It wasn't necessarily what Jehoshaphat did physically at all, but it's what he did spiritually. We'll touch on that again a little bit later. Verse 11. "Also, some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and silver as tribute. And the Arabians brought him flocks, 7,700 rams, 7,700 male goats. I have no idea why 7,700 and why it wasn't 7,707. You're going to get seven sevens, you may as well get three sevens together. But the enemies came to be at peace because of Jehoshaphat's righteousness, because of his love for God's way, his desire to spread God's way. Verse 12, so Jehoshaphat became increasingly powerful. He built fortresses and storage cities in Judah, continued to develop that hedge. Verse 13, he had much property in the cities of Judah, and the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem. God greatly blessed him for what? Because he built a hedge against evil. He took pleasure in God's way, held it in high esteem, and he spread God's truth as much as he was able to others. The next few verses go on to show that he had a huge standing army. There was probably no one since the time of Solomon that had an equal to Jehoshaphat in the extent of his revenue, in the strength of his fortifications, the number of troops. An outstanding individual. God was very pleased with this man. Now, there's another important lesson that we can learn from Jehoshaphat. And it has to do with jelly beans. Fourth lesson. I must keep my distance from evil. I must keep my distance from evil. Jehoshaphat, as things were going well, had a lapse in judgment. And he allowed evil to get very close to home. Let's read about that in chapter 18. 2 Chronicles 18, Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance. Why? Well, because he built a hedge against evil. He took pleasure in God's way, loved God's way, delighted in God's way. He taught God's way to the rest of his people, was never ashamed of God's way. But the rest of verse 1 says, and by marriage, he allied himself with Ahab. Bad idea. You see, after Baasha dies in the northern kingdom, later on Ahab takes over as the new king over Israel. And Ahab was another evil man. Ahab, likewise, was a murderer. Murdered a man for his property. Just had him killed. Ahab was allied, was married to probably one of the most evil women ever recorded in the scripture, that of Jezebel. So what is Jehoshaphat thinking when he makes a pact with such an evil man? I wasn't thinking straight. He made a bad judgment. Have righteous people ever made bad judgments before? Okay, you're all looking at me. Of course. What can we learn? Oh, we've got to keep our distance from evil. Don't ally ourselves or align ourselves with someone who is evil. You see, typically in the political world, pretty decent people will sometimes align themselves with evil people if they think they have a common objective. And that's a serious mistake. God specifically talks about that as we go through this story. So he allied himself with Ahab. After some years, he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria. It says he went down. Samaria was north of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem was a higher elevation, so he went downhill north to visit with Ahab. And Ahab killed sheep and oxen in abundance for him and the people who were with him, and persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. Now, what was the point? You see, Ahab wined and dined Jehoshaphat. Big spread for him and all his people. Said, look, Jehoshaphat, I need you to do one thing. Joe, baby, Jehoshaphat, I need you to do one thing for me. Just need you to, just a small couple of battles here with the Syrians up at Ramoth, and that would be a tremendous help. So, verse 3, Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead? And he answered him, as I am, or I am as you are, and my people as your people, we will be with you in the war. Good decision or foolish decision? It was a really bad decision. Righteous man, bad decision. It happens. And when we say keep our distance from evil, kind of a sub-point here is do not align yourself with evil. Even if you have common goals. And they did have a common goal. That was the Syrians were problems. The Syrians were wicked people. The Syrians were a threat. So they had a common enemy, we might say. But don't align yourself with evil to accomplish the goal. Verse 4, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, please inquire for the word of the Eternal today, the word of Yahweh. The king of Israel gathered the prophets together, 400 men. What other story do you think about 400 prophets? Or 450 prophets of who? Of Baal. Jezebel and her 400 prophets. So who was it that Ahab was calling together? It was all these prophets of Baal. Now the interesting thing is while they were prophets of Baal, they used the name of God oftentimes. Much like today. We have prophets and preachers of Baal all over the place who use the name of God, who use the name of Jesus Christ. But are in the middle of all kinds of pagan thoughts and ceremonies and ideas and practices. Same thing happening today in a sense. So they said, go up, for God will deliver it into the hand of the king. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not still a prophet of the Eternal here that we may inquire of him? At least Jehoshaphat was sharp enough to know these guys might use God's name. But look at the way they're dancing around and cutting themselves and doing all. These are not prophets of God. So he said, look, I want the real thing. Is there anybody up here in Israel who still represents Yahweh, represents the true God? So the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there is still one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh. But I hate him because he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. He is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. Now, why would Micaiah always prophesy evil? Because Ahab was an evil person. Micaiah would always tell the truth. So isn't that an interesting thing as well? Usually a carnal mind will hate those who tell them the truth. An interesting thing to see that happen. They don't deal with the issue, they deal with the person. It wasn't, maybe I should analyze what Micaiah says to see if it's true. It's, I hate that guy. Didn't want to hear the truth. Jehoshaphat said, oh, come on, let not the king say such things. Now, what must Jehoshaphat have been looking at? Up to this point, Ahab had been a pretty successful king. He was rich. He put out this huge spread for them. His territory seemed fairly secure. In fact, he might have been here going to expand his territory a little bit by this battle. So, Jehoshaphat felt maybe God was blessing him. Oh, don't say such things. Verse 8. Then the king of Israel called one of his officers and said, bring Micaiah, the son of Imlah, quickly. Ahab wanted to get this over before the magic of the event was gone and Jehoshaphat might reconsider. At least that seems to me what's going on. The king of Israel called one of his officers, bring Micaiah. Then in verse 9, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, clothed in their robes, sat each on his throne. They sat at a threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets prophesied before them. Now Zedekiah, the son of Chiana, had made horns of iron for himself. And he said, thus says the Eternal. Well, there he is using God's name. With these you shall gore the Syrians until they are destroyed. So can you picture it like the huge lady at the end of the opera with the hat on and the horn sticking out? He's got these iron horns and he's running around. Again, Jehoshaphat says, who is this character? This is not representative of the real God, I can tell you that. But he was representing all 400 of these others. Verse 11, and all the prophets prophesied so. They all said the same thing. Go up to Ramoth Gilead and prosper, for the Eternal will deliver it into your king's hand, into the king's hand. They used God's name. And yet they were all prophets, false prophets, prophets of the Baals. Verse 12, then the messenger who had gone to Micaiah, to call Micaiah, spoke to him. So you kind of see what's going on here. As he's pulling Micaiah to come appear before the kings, he sits him in the green room and says, let me give you some background here before you go out there. The background is this. Now listen, the words of the prophets with one accord encourage the king. 400 prophets have just told Ahab, everything's fine, go up, you'll be successful. Give him a word of encouragement. If you know what's good for you, Micaiah, tell him the right thing. Therefore, please let your word be like the word of one of them, and speak encouragement. Micaiah is not intimidated by this in the least little bit. He says, as the Eternal lives, whatever my God says, that I will speak. Then he came to the king, and the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to war against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I refrain? Now there was something about Micaiah's answer that it was clear and obvious that he was mocking Ahab. Because, what does Micaiah say? End of verse 14. And he said, go and prosper, they shall be delivered into your hand. Isn't that what the other 400 said? Yeah, go and prosper, everything's going to be fine, really. No problem. Just go ahead up there, you'll be successful. Yeah, I don't know what it was. But there was something about that that he knew he was mocking him. Maybe he was just saying it in the same kind of sing-songy, strange way that all these other prophets had said it. Maybe he put his horns to his head. Oh yeah, go prosper, you'll be fine. Don't know. But whatever it was, he knew he was mocking him. So verse 15, the king said to him, how many times shall I make you swear that you tell me nothing but the truth in the name of the Eternal? And with that statement, I would imagine Micaiah's face froze in a stare directly into the eyes of Ahab. Then he said, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Eternal said, these have no master. Let each return to his house in peace. What was he saying? Ahab, you're going to die. You will not walk out of this battle alive. Verse 17. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, didn't I not tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me but evil? Then Micaiah said, again staring no doubt right in Ahab's eyes, therefore hear the word of the Eternal. I saw the Eternal sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing on his right hand and his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab, king of Israel, to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead? So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. You almost get an idea of here's a picture of how the spirit world functions at times. That all these hosts, these angels, are appearing before God. Now, in this case, it was a lying spirit. One of the demons, apparently, that would have spoke to God and given a suggestion. And that shouldn't seem unusual to us, because in the book of Job, Satan himself appears before God. And God says, have you seen my servant Job? What an upstanding man he is. And he says, the only reason he's doing that is, you know, you remember the story. Verse 20, then a spirit came forward and stood before the Eternal and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said to him, in what way? Verse 21, so he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Well, demons easily lie. Righteous angels don't lie. So this lying spirit was going to go down and convince Ahab to go up to Ramoth Gilead. I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. All his prophets, not God's prophets. God's prophets would not be lying, but all 400 of the false ones would be. And the Eternal said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Therefore, look. The Eternal has put a lying spirit in the mouth of these prophets of yours. They're not my prophets, God says. They're yours. And the Eternal has declared disaster against you. And you ask yourself the question, what was Jehoshaphat thinking to align himself with Ahab, the murdering thief king to the north? Verse 23, then Zedekiah, the son of Chanana, went near and struck Micaiah on the cheek, slapped him in the face, and said, which way did the Spirit from the Eternal go from me to speak to you? Now, isn't that a spirit of love and humility that all of God's prophets would have? No, not at all. He was insulted. Micaiah said, indeed you shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber and hide. Now you wonder if he wasn't predicting later on what would happen with Elijah when all these prophets would be slain for their sin, would be murdered. Verse 25, then the king of Israel said, take Micaiah, return him to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, thus says the king, put this fellow in prison and feed him with the bread of affliction and the water of affliction until I return in peace. Give him bread and water till I get back. But Micaiah said in verse 27, if you ever return in peace, the Eternal has not spoken by me. And he said, take heed, all you people. And my guess is he was looking Jehoshaphat right in the eye when he said that. So be careful. Keep our distance from evil. Do not align ourselves with evil people, even if we have common goals. We will pay for it in the long run. Verse 28. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and they went into battle. Now, would you say Jehoshaphat was a slight bit naive? Seems to be. Righteousness does not always mean good judgment or perfect judgment. What was Ahab hoping to accomplish? He probably knew the Syrians' battle plan, and that was kill the leaders and the rest will go away. So he's going to disguise himself as a common everyday soldier so that if the Syrians pursue, they're going to go for Jehoshaphat and not for Ahab. But Jehoshaphat didn't get it. Didn't see it. Oh, I think, yeah. He probably said to him various things. Well, look, you stay back in your royal robes. Let the fellows do the fighting. I'm more of a fighter myself, so I'm going to go right into the battle. But you should stay back and make sure that your flags and your banners are there so they see that and they're intimidated by that. Who knows what pile of you-know-what was fed to Jehoshaphat. But he believed it, apparently. So he was a bit naive. Unfortunately, he made a bad judgment. He threw some jelly beans against the trailer. Bad judgment. Good man, but made a bad judgment. Verse 30, now the Syrian, the king of Syria, had commanded the captains of the chariots who were with him, saying, fight with no one, small or great, but only with the king of Israel. Cut off the head, the body dies, they all go away. That was his plan. So it was when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they said, it is the king of Israel. Therefore, they surrounded him to attack. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Eternal helped him, and God diverted them from him. God saw Jehoshaphat, naive, yes, but righteous, striving to obey God. Even though he made a really bad judgment, God did not desert him. He made a stupid alliance with Ahab. God did not desert him. So if we've made bad judgments, trust that God will not simply leave us on our own. Jehoshaphat cried out and God delivered him. Verse 32, 4, so it was when the captains of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. They were men who followed their orders exactly. They saw the flag and it said Judah and not Israel or something. Somehow they determined that this was not the king of Israel. So rather than kill him, they immediately turned away because their order was to fight only with the king of Israel. Verse 33, now a certain man drew a bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the joints of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around, take me out of the battle, for I am wounded. The battle increased that day, and the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot facing the Syrians until evening, and about the time of sunset, he died. Jehoshaphat should never have been anywhere near this battle. He made a bad judgment. Chapter 19 and verse 1, next verse. Then Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, should you help the wicked? What were you doing there? Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the eternal? How could you align yourself with this character? Therefore, the wrath of the eternal is upon you. Nevertheless, good things are found in you, and that you've removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God. He was not going to get the full brunt of punishment because he was a good man. Strove to live God's way, made a bad judgment, was blinded by what? Power? Gaining wealth? Hey, if we move that border further to the north and Israel protects us from the north, then we don't have to worry about that. We can divert these individuals to other areas. Who knows what he was thinking, but a bad judgment. What do we learn from that? Keep our distance from evil. Do not align ourselves with evil people, even if we have a common goal. What's a fifth lesson we can learn from Jehoshaphat? It's this. The righteous strive to influence others for good. The righteous strive to influence others for good. Here in 2 Chronicles chapter 19 in verse 4, we see the extent of Jehoshaphat's desire to influence others for good. And we have that desire, at least I hope we do. I believe we do. I certainly see evidence of that. That even if we're dealing with people out in the world, we strive to give them what they need to improve their lives, improve their programs, improve what they're doing, and influence others for good. It's the right thing. 2 Chronicles 19 and verse 4, Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out among the people from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim, and brought them back to the eternal God of their fathers. Good thing. Really wanted them to do what was right. Verse 5. Then he set judges in the land throughout all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed to what you are doing. Be careful. For you do not judge for man, but for the eternal. He wanted to be sure that they were perfect in their judgment. They were honorable in their judgment. They weren't working on behalf of Jehoshaphat. They were working on behalf of God. You do not judge for man, but for the eternal who is with you in the judgment. In one sense, it's God you have to answer to, not me. That's a much higher standard. Verse 7. Now, therefore, let the fear of the eternal be upon you. Take care and do it, for there is no iniquity with the eternal our God, no partiality, no taking of bribes. Moreover, in Jerusalem, for the judgment of the eternal and for controversies, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and priests, some of the chief fathers of Israel, when they returned to Jerusalem. And he commanded them, saying, thus you shall act in the fear of the eternal, faithfully and with a loyal heart. What was he trying to do? He was trying to influence others for good. Verse 11, take notice. Amariah, the chief priest, is over you in all matters of the eternal. And Zebediah, the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites will be officials before you. Behave courageously, and the eternal will be with the good. God's people love to influence others for good. Help them in whatever way we can. We want to see their lives successful. That leads us to the final lesson that we'll have time to cover today, and that is faith and trust in God is critical. Faith and trust in God is critical to a Christian's life, as it was to Jehoshaphat. Look in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Beginning in verse 1, it happened after this that the people of Moab, with the people of Ammon, and others with them besides the Ammonites, came to battle against Jehoshaphat. What had we read earlier? We had read that because Jehoshaphat built a hedge against evil, because he took pleasure in God's way and held it in high esteem, and because he loved spreading the truth of God to others, God made his enemies to be at peace. Now he aligns himself with Ahab, and what happens? All of a sudden, there's enemies coming to his door. There is cause and effect. At work in all of our lives, God uses that to teach us lessons. Verse 2. Then some came and told Jehoshaphat, saying, "A great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, from Syria." Sounds familiar? "And they are in Hazazon, Tamar, which is En-Gedi." And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Eternal and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. Pause for a moment. Here's a huge threat. Probably certain destruction. What was the solution? Prayer and fasting. Unfortunately, in the Church of God community over the course of time, prayer and fasting has taken a bad rap. I remember one individual, a mocker, who had been a part of the Church of God, sadly, standing up one day and saying, "Oh, so you got some marriage problems? You know what the pastor told me to do? Pray and fast. What's that going to do for my marriage problems?" Another person has financial problems. "You know what the pastor said? Pray and fast about it. What's that going to do? Is that going to get more money in my pocket?" Oh my, oh my. Wait for lightning to strike in situations like that. You mock God like that? How many soldiers would praying and fasting bring to Judah? Zero. How many swords would be produced by praying and fasting? Zero. How many hearts of Syrians would be changed by praying and fasting? Oh, now we're talking about something that can't be measured. How many bosses' hearts have I seen changed by praying and fasting? Plenty. He proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. You see, as we read earlier in Mr. Frank's letter, for example, these problems are spiritual in nature, and they require spiritual solutions, not physical solutions. So, does the world have the answer? You got a marriage problem, you want to go to the local psychologist and get that straightened out? You think that's going to help? Oh, it might provide a few tools. But the solution is spiritual in nature. And yes, praying and fasting will bring a solution. It will. Verse 4. So Judah gathered together to ask help from the Eternal. And from all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Eternal. Faith and trust in God is critically important. It is the solution. Then Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem, in the house of the Eternal, before the new court, and said, "O Eternal God of our fathers, you, are you not God in heaven? And do you not rule over all the kingdoms of the nations? And in your hand is there not power and might, so that no one is able to withstand you? Are you not our God, who drove out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel, and gave it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend, forever? And they dwell in it, and have built you a sanctuary in it for your name, saying, if disaster comes upon us, sword, judgment, pestilence, or famine, we will stand before the temple and in your presence, for your name is in this temple, cry out to you in our afflictions, and you will hear and save. My personal opinion is Jehoshaphat realized that he was partially at fault for this. But he said, God, you promised. And Solomon mentioned that in his prayer. If my people, if these people, after they do stupid things, and they start getting punished for it, and they turn to you and they cry out, you will answer. You will hear. Didn't you say that, God? Jehoshaphat's in a very repentant attitude, it seems, at this point in his life. Verse 10. And now here are the people of Ammon, Moab, Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and did not destroy them. Here they are rewarding us by coming to throw us out of your possession, which you have given to us to inherit. O God, O our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power against this great multitude that's coming against us, nor do we know what to do. But our eyes are upon you. There are issues we face in life, brethren. We just don't know what to do. The solution is spiritual in nature. Prayer and fasting does draw us closer to God. Solutions and answers do come through that process. It is not an empty process by any means. It is not self-denial or self-flagellation for that sake. It is an attempt to draw close to God and ask for His intervention in our lives. Search for His will. Search for the answer through a spiritual means. Verse 13, now all Judah, with their little ones, their wives, and their children, stood before the Eternal. They were all there. They all, with one heart, sought God. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, son of Jeziel, son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, in the midst of the assembly, and said, listen, all of you Judah and you inhabitants of Jerusalem, and you King Jehoshaphat, thus says the Eternal, you do not be afraid nor dismayed because of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. What are you battling? What are we battling? It is not God's. It's not our battle. It is God's battle. If we turn to Him in prayer and fasting and supplication, certainly God will hear. Tomorrow, go down against them. They will surely come up by the ascent of Ziz, and you will find them at the end of the brook before the wilderness of Jeruel. You will not need to fight in this battle. Position yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Eternal who is with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not fear or be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Eternal is with you. Spiritual solution. Faith and trust in God is critically important. Jehoshaphat trusted God. So even though greatly outnumbered, inferior force in every way, they went out. Jehoshaphat, verse 18, bowed his head with his face to the ground. All Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem bowed before the Eternal, worshiping the Eternal. Then the Levites and the children of the Kohathites and of the children of the Korathites stood up to praise the Eternal God of Israel with voices loud and high. They sang a psalm. Verse 20, they rose early in the morning, went out to the wilderness of Tekoa, and as they went out, Jehoshaphat stood and said, hear me, O Judah and Jerusalem, believe in the Eternal your God, and you shall be established. You need your marriage established? Believe in the Lord. Trust God. Fast. Draw close to Him, and your marriage will be better. It will. Believe in the Eternal. Believe in the Eternal your God, and you shall be established. Believe His prophets, and you shall prosper. And when He consulted with the people, He appointed those who should sing to the Eternal and who should praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army and were saying, praise the Lord, His mercy endures forever. Who led the army? The singers. It's not a particularly enviable position when you're going against swords and stakes. But they trusted God. singers must have as well. Now when they began to sing and praise, the Eternal set ambushes against the people of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, who had come against Judah. And they were defeated, for the people of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir to utterly kill and destroy them. They fought amongst themselves. And when they made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, they helped to destroy one another. Mistrust, anger, upset, completely unpredictable, God brought it to pass. Facing a battle against someone else, turn it into God's hands. Stand back and let God intervene. Let Him take care of it. It's His job. He's very good at it. So when Judah came to a place overlooking the wilderness, verse 24, they looked toward the multitude, and there were their dead bodies fallen on the earth. Not one had escaped. So the last two guys stabbed each other simultaneously and fell over dead. It's amazing. God intervened. When Jehoshaphat and his people came to take away their spoil, they found among them an abundance of valuables on the dead bodies and precious jewelry, which they stripped off for themselves more than they could carry. They were 3 days gathering the spoil because there was so much. Not only did God intervene, protect them from their enemies, He enriched them from their enemies. Faith and trust in God is indispensable for the people of God. Physical problems have spiritual solutions. And that's where a Christian's focus should be. Not fixing the physical, but tuning the spiritual. The other things will take care of themselves at the right time and in the right way. Let's summarize. Did Jehoshaphat live a perfect life from this time forward? No. Did he still make some bad judgments? Yes. But was he a righteous man that we can learn from? Absolutely. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 here in verse 31. So Jehoshaphat was king over Judah. He was 35 years old when he became king. He reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhai. And he walked, in verse 32, in the ways of his father Asa, and did not turn aside from it, doing what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did what was right. He wasn't perfect. He made some mistakes. He made some bad judgments. In fact, he'd continue to do so. But he was a righteous man, so much like so many of us in the Church of God today. People who are striving to be righteous, not perfect, but striving to align our heart with God's. So, brethren, Jehoshaphat's life stands as a testimony for us today. Let us strive to learn and put into practice the great lessons from the life of righteous King Jehoshaphat.